Good morning. It's nice to see everyone here this morning. If you would, please be turning in your Bibles to Mark chapter 15. That will be our text for this morning. We're going to begin by reading verses 16 through 41. I know it's a bit of a lengthy reading, but I think it's necessary to establish what we're going to be talking about, and I think it's well worth our time. Mark 15, 16 through 41. And the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort. And they dressed him up in purple, and after weaving a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting at him and kneeling and bowing before him. And after they had mocked him, they took the purple off him and put his garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. And they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And they crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And he was numbered with transgressors." And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "Ha, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priest also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe." And those who were crucified with him were casting the same insult at him. And when the sixth hour had come, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And when some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, "Behold, he is calling for Elijah." And someone ran and filled the sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink, saying, "Let us see whether Elijah will come take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." And there were also some women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Less, and Joseph and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. Well, you probably recognize this was in our daily Bible reading just a week or so ago. And I happen to be listening to the Bible reading that day. Some days I listen, some days I actually read, and some days I even read and listen at the same time. And I find those different ways of doing the Bible reading helpful. But as I was listening, I was struck by all the different groups of people that Mark mentions here that were present at the crucifixion. And I went back and read through the chapter, and I tried to identify each group. And I thought, you know, this might be an interesting study to examine and consider each one of these groups and some possible lessons we might be able to learn from them. And that's what I've done for this morning. And I've entitled this lesson, "The Seven Faces of the Crucifixion." So let us begin by looking at these seven different faces, these different groups of people that we have mentioned that were present at the crucifixion of Christ, at least in Mark's account, and Matthew is very similar. And we'll be looking at a number of passages as we go along. We're going to go through them relatively quickly, so I don't apologize for that. And this might be a lengthy lesson, but I've got an extra hour, so I think we're okay. But the first face I'd like for us to look at is the face of the Roman soldiers. And we find them mentioned in verse 22 of Mark 15. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated the place of a skull. And if you were just reading verse 22, you wouldn't know who brought them. We'd have to go back to verse 16 to see that it was these very soldiers that were there present, really beating Jesus at Pilate's command there. And we're told that they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And I think we need to be careful about thinking that this was an act of kindness on their part. I mean, these are the men we just read that brutally beat Jesus and mocked him and humiliated him and spit on him. Why would they all of a sudden be merciful to him? I don't think that's what's happening here. I think what's happening is what they have here is this kind of a narcotic mix that they gave these men they were about to crucify them to subdue them, to keep them quiet. This wasn't merciful. I think this was practical. This wasn't for Jesus' sake. It was to try to make their job easier, I believe. It's what happened. I mean, this is the same band of men that had just beaten him. And most believe that Jesus refused this mixture because he wanted his senses intact. He wanted to be completely sober-minded during these events, which is hard for us to believe. I think I would want the whole bucket, but he did not want that. He refused it. And in John's account, we're told that there were four of these soldiers, one soldier for every part of the garment that was divided into four parts. So it wasn't a whole group of soldiers there present at the crucifixion. At least we don't see that. We only see four of them. Now, maybe there were some others on the outskirts kind of keeping guard, but the only ones we have mentioned are these four. Their presence there was not voluntary, was it? This was an assignment they were given, and they were going to be there as long as it took. It was their job. And one gets the impression this was not their first crucifixion. I mean, think about it. There were three crucifixions that day alone. In one day. This was commonplace. It was so commonplace that Jesus used crucifixion as an illustration in his teaching on a number of occasions. I read in Josephus where there were 800 Pharisees that were crucified at one event or one time for some kind of rebellion. This was commonplace. This was this man's job. This was just a day's work to them. And Matthew even tells us that after crucifying him and dividing up his garments, they sat down. Well, let's might as well sit down. And if they have to be there, they're at least going to get some clothing out of it, get something out of their day's work. You know, they have no idea that what they are doing is fulfilling a prophecy that was given 1,000 years before. Psalm 22:18, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. These are the men who literally nailed Jesus to the cross. And it appears it meant nothing more to them than driving a nail into a block of wood. Jesus was nothing to them. And all the evidence indicates that he was just another criminal to mock. Luke 23 tells us that. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." And it seems to me that they offered him wine again throughout this process, going along with the crowd. Well, those are the Roman soldiers. The next face we have are the criminals, the two criminals. And Matthew and Mark both refer to them as robbers, and they crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. That's verse 27 of Mark 15. Like the soldiers, these men are not there by any choice of their own, are they? They have no choice in the matter whatsoever. They are apparently common thieves and perhaps even partners in crime. We don't know that, but it's quite possible that they were arrested together. And now they are suffering the same fate. They have been tried and condemned and are now being executed for the same crime. And we're specifically told here they were crucified on either side of Jesus. And what we read here in Mark is this was also fulfillment of prophecy. And we have the prophecy here in Isaiah 53:12. We'll just read the center section there. Because he poured himself out to death and was numbered with the transgressors. They don't know this is fulfillment of prophecy, but this also is a fulfillment of prophecy. And, you know, these men are there hanging on crosses next to Jesus. And you would think they would just silently endure the suffering they're going through. But instead, they actually join in the mockery of Jesus. It says in Matthew 27:44, "Then the robbers also who had been crucified with him were casting the same insult at him." If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Or save us. Save us if you're the Son of God, they even said. You would think that if anyone present on that day would have been sympathetic toward Jesus, it would have been these men. But instead, they also mock him and cast insults at him, like the others present there. And we'll come back to them at the conclusion of the lesson. There's a little bit more to be said about them, as most of us know. And then we have this interesting group mentioned, those who passed by. And I want to spend a little bit of time with this group. You know, and we'll go ahead and read the verse here, Mark 15:29-30. "And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, 'Ha, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross.'" But what an interesting designation, those who passed by. Obviously, they're not there for the duration of this event. They're passing by. And there are only two possibilities here. One, that they just happened to be traveling, maybe to or from Jerusalem, and they passed by this horrible event that was taking place. Or the second, they have come there for the specific reason of witnessing this spectacle for themselves with no intention of staying. And I would suggest their actions and words reveal to us which reason they're there. It says they were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads. And what they don't know themselves, that this is another fulfillment of another prophecy. Psalm 22:27-28. "All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head, saying, 'Commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him.'" And notice what they say here. "You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." What an interesting thing to say to him. Because it just so happens that what they're shouting is the only evidence that they had for crucifying him at the trial earlier that morning. "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" That was the only accusation they could level against Jesus Christ. And these men just happened, coincidentally, to be shouting this at Jesus. I think it's difficult to overlook that they have an agenda here. They may have been part of that same group or certainly influenced by them. They are there, it seems to me, for the specific purpose of mocking Jesus. And what occurs to me is they don't realize that the very accusation they're leveling against him is the very thing he is in the process of doing. He is destroying that temple that he is going to raise in 3 days. And we know that he is talking about the temple of his body, as we read here in John 2, 18 through 21. But he was speaking of the temple of his body. The very fulfillment of his own words is taking place, and they are completely clueless to that idea. But I want to think about something. Why are they just passing by? I mean, you've got all these groups there, and we're going to look at some others, obviously, but why are they just passing by? Why aren't they there for the duration? You know, we're not told why, but I think there are a couple ideas worth considering. Mark tells us that it was the third hour when they crucified Jesus. That's 9 a.m. our time. It was the third hour when they crucified him. And then he goes ahead and tells us later that it was at the ninth hour that Jesus cried out with a loud voice. And shortly after that, he said, "It is finished." So Jesus is on the cross for 6 hours. This ordeal lasts 6 hours. And that may just simply be the explanation for why they're passing by, that they're not going to spend an entire 6 hours witnessing this crucifixion. And that's quite possible. And that may be the most likely explanation. But I think there's something else that may go along with that and factor into that. This was the Jewish Passover. This is arguably the most holy feast day for the children of Israel to celebrate their release from the Egyptian bondage and captivity. And we're told in Exodus 12 that the lamb was to be killed at twilight. Twilight is a very interesting word, and I don't believe it's what we think of as twilight. A lot of times when we think of twilight, we think it's just right when the sun's going down and you're almost starting to see some stars. We call that twilight. But that's not the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word for twilight actually means between the two evenings. It's a very interesting word. And from my research and understanding, I've got this chart here to try to explain this, that they called noon, when the sun was at its highest point in the sky, the first evening, right before it began to descend towards sunset. And then they called sunset the second evening. So, see, they didn't have watches. They didn't have clocks. They didn't know when to do anything other than by where the sun was in the sky. They might have had a sundial, but this is how they told time. So when it says that they were to sacrifice the lamb at twilight, that meant between the sun, where the sun was at its highest at noon, and then at sunset at 6 p.m., which would have been what time? At the sixth hour, at 3 p.m. So they can't stand there. I mean, these are Jews who are obedient, you know, children of Israel. They've got to get home. They've got to go sacrifice this lamb. Any self-respecting Jew would not disobey the command to do this. I mean, this is the most holy feast day of the year for the children of Israel. Well, you might have already made this connection. But when did Jesus breathe his last? At 3 p.m. on the 14th of Nisan, the exact day and time the Passover lamb was to be killed. These men were going home, possibly, to sacrifice the Passover lamb, and they just rejected and ridiculed and hurled abuse at the very fulfillment of that spiritual Passover. Paul says that Christ is our Passover. And they walked past right by him, wagging their heads. Well, the next group we have are the chief priests and the scribes in verses 31 through 32. In the same way, just like they were hurling abuse at Jesus, the chief priest also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe." And there were likely Pharisees there. The scribes were actually, for the most part, made up of Pharisees, I believe. And Matthew adds that there were elders there. But of all the faces present at the crucifixion, you know, these are probably the ones we're the most familiar with. We know why they're there, don't we? We know what their motives are. There is no questioning this at all. They were there to destroy him. They wanted to get rid of this man for 3 years because he exposed their hypocrisy. He exposed their agenda. He exposed their self-righteousness, all of these things, and they didn't like it. Notice what we're told in Mark 11:18. Just 11:15, excuse me. I think that's supposed to be 18, I'm sorry. It's one or the other. And the chief priests and the scribes heard this. This is when Jesus actually, I believe, said some things about casting out the money changers in the temple. And they began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him, for all the multitude was astonished at his teaching. They wanted to get rid of him. That's why they were there. We're not told they were passing by. Now, that doesn't mean they stayed the entire time, but it wouldn't be surprise me if their hatred toward Jesus caused them to stay there, to witness this entire event, even missing the time to sacrifice the Passover lamb just to see him die on the cross. And what they say here begs the question, "Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe." Do you think they would have believed? They would have found some explanation for it. They would have dismissed it. Jesus knew that. There is no way they would have believed. But what they did not know, what they had been given every reason to believe for the past 3 years, was this was the Son of God, and that he could come down from the cross if he wanted to. With one word, he could have obliterated all of those who were there casting insults at him. But he didn't. He remained there because of his love for even these men who were saying such vile things to him. He had actually demonstrated his power to them so many times. Just even the night before. This is an amazing passage. We've looked at it before. This is when they came to arrest Jesus. And Jesus said, "Who are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also was betraying him, was standing with him. When therefore he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. What does that say? That his answer had power and it knocked them down. But it didn't stop them. That's what's amazing to me. In light of everything he did and everything he said and everything he demonstrated, it didn't keep them from wanting to kill him. Jesus said himself in Matthew's account, "Put your sword away, Peter. Don't you know I can ask my Father and he will send me 12 legions of angels?" He could have stopped all of this with a word. But he chose to suffer on the cross in pain and agony and humiliation because of his love for them and because of his love for us. And I'm reminded of what we're told in 1 Peter 2:22 through 24.
He committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. They sought to destroy him, but he sought to save them. Then we have the bystanders, not to be confused with the passerbys. This is interesting. The bystanders. And it's hard to know what to make of these so-called bystanders. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And when some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, "Behold, he's calling for Elijah." And someone ran and filled the sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink, saying, "Let us see whether Elijah will come take him down." But the word bystander, by its very nature, is kind of neutral sounding to me. They're really not there with any kind of agenda, it doesn't appear. They're there to observe, to see kind of what's happening here, unlike those who are passing by who clearly had an agenda. By their comments, it seems to me they are clearly Jewish, though somehow they mistake Jesus' cry to God for a cry to Elijah. Maybe they didn't hear it well. Maybe Jesus didn't speak it, perhaps, that clearly, being on the cross for nearly 6 hours at this time. But in contrast to the Roman soldiers and the chief priests and scribes, they don't appear to be mocking him. It seems that they really maybe think Elijah may still come take him down. No, noticed, you know, the soldiers offered Jesus the wine in order to mock him. It says that. They did that mocking him. But in John 19, what we're told here is that they took, let's go ahead and read this, verse 28 and 29. "After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished, in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, 'I am thirsty.' A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of the sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it up to his mouth." And it seems to me that they're responding to his request for thirst. And they're putting this wine up to his mouth to give him a drink. And maybe what they're thinking is, if he can just hold on long enough, maybe Elijah will come and bring him down. And incidentally, I think it's interesting that John mentions a branch of hyssop here. Why? Why would he detail a branch of hyssop? Does it matter what kind of branch they use to put the sponge on? Well, if you look over at Exodus 12 and 22, it's the same type of plant that they were instructed to take and apply the blood of the Passover to the house with. And incidentally, where was that blood to be applied? They were applied some of the blood in the basin to the lintel, that's the header if you're in construction, and the two doorposts. And some of you I know are very familiar with this figure. Here's my drawing of a house. It's not a Les Wicker, by the way, but this is Rick Harrington. This is my drawing of a house. So you see the lintel and the two doorposts. Well, they were to apply the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts. And I would presume that if you applied it there to the lintel, some of that blood would have dripped down. And this is for the Passover. And what do we see was applied there? We see a cross. To me, that's just too coincidental to ignore. Is it coincidental? The branch of hyssop that was held up to Jesus' mouth was the same type of wood used to apply this blood to the lintels and the doorpost to keep death from entering that house. Did they know what they were doing when they did that? No. They had no idea. And I wonder if these bystanders were the ones who perhaps were followers of Jesus, witnessing the signs he performed, but just on the fence about who he was. And maybe they were there, hoping that one last miracle, Elijah would come and take him. Something would finally determine once and for all that this is the Christ, the Son of God, to them. Let's not forget that the sky had been dark from the sixth hour to the ninth hour for 3 hours throughout the land, we are told. What did they think when Elijah did not come and take him down? What was their response? Just a couple more. Then we have the centurion. This is Mark 15, 37 through 39. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last, and the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." I love reading about the centurions in the New Testament. They are always shown in a positive light. I mean, these are men of great authority and always seem to present a great character. And they command respect from those under them. But like the soldiers there, his presence was not voluntary either, was it? He was there to oversee these things, to make sure everything happened according as it was supposed to, make sure no riots broke out or anything like that, which there certainly was a potential with the different parties represented. But we aren't given any insight into what his opinion of Jesus Christ was. He's there as an observer. In all three synoptic gospels, it's noted that Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. And we're told in John what he cried out. "It is finished." This is not a whimper. This is not a cry of pain, it seems to me. This is a shout of victory. "It is finished." But unless this centurion spoke Aramaic, I don't think he understood what Jesus said, but he understood something. And we're told that in Matthew's account, that when he cried out, that in addition to the veil of the temple being torn, which no one would have known about at the site of the crucifixion, the earth shook and the rock split. And it seems to me that this happened at exactly the same time. And it says, when the centurion saw that, he cried out, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Seems to me he came to the only honest and reasonable conclusion one could come to after witnessing what happened, after 3 hours of darkness, after Jesus crying out, and at the very exact moment, the earth shaking and the rock splitting. But notice what we're told in Matthew 27 and 54. And I actually never recognized this before. "Now the centurion and those who were with him keeping guard over Jesus." Who is that? The Roman soldiers who had just nailed him to the cross, who had brutally beaten him. "When they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, became very frightened and said, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" There's no reason to ask why they were frightened, is there? What they had just done and what they had just witnessed. But the centurion's word and their words convey that what he did not understand and what none present there that day understood was that this was not over. He's saying this was the Son of God in past tense. This is not the end of Jesus' life, but the fulfillment of everything he came to this earth to accomplish. And finally, the last group we have, as Mark describes them, are the women. And there are a lot of interesting details we could talk about. We'll go ahead and read this, and I'll point out a couple. And there were also some women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph, and Salome. And he was in Galilee. They used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. And if you compare all four gospel accounts, there's a lot of things you can see there. That it appears, and I'll just say this real quick. I don't want to get into a lot of detail and look at all the verses. That Salome is actually the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. That's because you will see that if you compare the accounts. And it's also quite possible that Salome is the sister of Jesus' mother, Mary, which would make Jesus and James and John cousins, which might explain why the mother of James and John came to Jesus asking preferential treatment for her two sons. And might also explain why Jesus gave John the task, the responsibility of caring for his mother because she was his nephew. So some interesting things. You can't say all of these things conclusively, but if you compare all four gospel accounts and look at those in detail, you will see that's quite a possibility. And incidentally, I understand that someone recently asked, nobody's put any suggestions in the black and white box about sermons yet. I keep looking in there to make sure I'll give them to Les or somebody, but but please do, though. But it came to our attention in the business meeting the other night that a couple questions were asked. And one was, who is James the Less, and why is he called James the Less? Well, you know, since it's here, I'll just talk about that for a quick moment. Well, he's apparently the son of Mary, and possibly the son of Clopas, if you look at one of the other accounts. And I think the only reason he's called James the Less is to distinguish him from another James, probably the James of James and John. And it doesn't mean he's inferior. It probably means he's younger or he's smaller. Linda Smith, from my understanding, was called Little Linda as she was growing up, because there was another Linda that a person of the same name in her family. I was called Ricky, just to distinguish me from my dad, who was Rick, but his name's not Rick. He stole my name. But so it's that sort of thing. The James the Less is basically kind of a nickname to say that this is the younger James, or distinguish him from another James. But I just thought I would point that out. If that doesn't answer your question, then Daryl will probably answer it next time he talks. But what's interesting is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all specifically mention that these women were standing at a distance. But John states in his gospel that at least Mary and Salome and him were standing by the cross. But they were standing by the cross of Jesus. His mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene, when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. And then we have the exchange between him and John and his mother. So which one is it? Were they standing at a distance, or were they standing near the cross? Is that a contradiction? Well, I think if we look at John's account, this took place right at the beginning of the time when Jesus was crucified, right after his garments were divided among the soldiers. And when we look at the synoptic gospels, it's at the very end of these 6 hours. And it's not hard to imagine why Jesus' mother and these other women would not have wanted to stay near. I can almost see her pushing away, saying, "I can't bear to watch this anymore. Please take me away from here." Because her own son is nailed there on the cross, suffering. And it reminds me of the prophecy of Simeon that Mary and Joseph were given when they brought Jesus to the temple as a baby, where Simeon said, "Behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rise of many in Israel, and for a sign to be opposed, and a sword will pierce even your own soul, to the end that thoughts from many hearts may be revealed." And I wonder if she remembered that as she witnessed what happened to her son that afternoon. You know, of all the faces mentioned at the crucifixion, we know that this group of women, there were actually, it says in Luke, that there were acquaintances there as well, and the Apostle John was there, that these were the individuals who were there for the purest of motives. They were there because they were loyal to Jesus, because they believed in Him. They had followed Him for 3 years now. But as we see in the chapters that follow, that belief was really wrenched from their hearts as He was nailed to the cross that day. Well, to wrap things up, I want to note what we are told about this entire multitude, these seven faces, as Luke concludes his gospel. And he says here in verse 48 of chapter 23, "And all the multitudes who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breast." All who left that day left beating their breast. What do we make of all of these different groups of people? What do we make of these things that we're being told here? What's the lesson for us? I think we had some as we studied these things. Well, to everybody who left that scene that day, what appeared to happen was a horrible tragedy. Not one individual who walked away from that scene thought it was anything other than that, except for maybe the chief priest and the scribes, who thought it was a victory on their part. A good and just man, one many believed to be the Messiah, even the Son of God, was nailed to the cross, was suffered for a crime he did not commit. And it was tragic. The hope he had offered so many appeared to die with him. But I think what we see through these various encounters with these different groups of individuals is that everything that took place that day was precisely what was supposed to take place. This was all orchestrated by God the Father. Jesus knew exactly what He was facing and what was going to happen. This was not a horrible tragedy. This was God showing His love for mankind. And everything that happened was what had been planned to happen from the very beginning. From before the foundation of the world, and this day it was finished. You know, of all these faces we have considered this morning, you know, which one represents me? Which one am I? And I think we could look through these seven groups of people and maybe find ourselves in this one at this time or in this one. But what's interesting is that the only individual other than Jesus Christ who seemed to somehow eventually understand at least something about what was taking place was one of those criminals on the cross. And here's what we're told in Luke 23, 39 through 43. And one of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." Seemed like he continued to do that. But the other answered and rebuking said, "Do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he was saying, "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." And perhaps of all the faces present there that day, this criminal is the best representation of you and me. Like each of us, he had mocked Jesus. Every time we sin, we mock him. We cast insults at him and his sacrifice for us. He mocked Jesus. We mocked Jesus. He hung there where each of us deserved to be tried and convicted and condemned for our sin. That's where we belong, on the cross. Yet the events of that day, the sky growing dark, perhaps Jesus speaking humbly to those who hurled abuse at him, for being forgiving of them even. Something caused this man to understand that he may have been a sinner deserving of condemnation, but this man on the cross next to whom he did not deserve what he was suffering had the means to save him. He has the means to save you and me as well. Those of us, all of us who are condemned for our sin. And just as all those stood before Jesus that day at the crucifixion, so we will one day stand before him in judgment. And what will he say to us? Will he have us enter the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world, or will we be condemned to eternal punishment? I appreciate your time this morning and your attention. If anyone is here today and has not yet given their life to Jesus Christ through obedience to his word, you have the opportunity to do that now. If you don't know what that is and you would like to understand more about that, we would be glad to help you with that. If you've been falling short of who you need to be, you can make that right this morning. You don't have to come forward to make that commitment. But you can if you feel you need to, and we would be glad to help you and assist you in any way we can.